It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today, our 12th and last talk in the series, The 16 Great Bodhisattva Precepts, is on anger. And to help you see yourself more clearly, I will offer you a test. So here's the question. And at the end, when we have questions, I'll answer this one first, and you can judge for yourself how you're doing. So this is the question. Picture yourself, you're the mother of two toddlers, and you've recently hired an au pair, a young man from South America, whose interest in outdoors and camping aligns with your family's. So you and your husband both work full time, and you've worked hard to welcome Salvador. You've showed him the city, you've provided everything he said he needed. He's 21 and he claims he loves kids and he's primarily there for the kids, but also to keep the house tidy and prep dinner so that when you come home, there's not much left for you to do. Today is the third time in a row when you've come home after a particularly hard day. You're a physician, and today someone died on your watch. You've come home to find the sink piled with dishes, toys all over the floor, the children fighting, and Salvador on the couch on his cell phone. The beginnings of dinner are nowhere in sight. You've brought this up twice. What is your response? That's the question. Some Buddhists, in order to attain the highest personal liberation, vow never to express anger or desire. They are called arhats, and with a feeling of utmost respect, bodhisattvas honor and even revere their attainments. The root meaning of arhat, by the way, is one who burns away or dries up all passions and defilements. That's the meaning of the word arhat. So they do what they're supposed to do. Bodhisattvas, on the other hand, vow to do anything that will realize the greatest welfare for all beings. So for bodhisattvas, whose way of awakening is the middle way, which really means, we use that word, but it really means middle between existence and non-existence. That's the ultimate meaning of that expression. But we also use it in Suzuki Roshi's meaning of not always so. So there's this because of that, and there's that because of this, and everything is contingent on everything, and so nothing is always the same. So for bodhisattvas, this precept means not to be angry when anger is inappropriate, but to be angry when anger is appropriate. So anger is part of the human condition. And for us, the question is how to live with anger in a way that's beneficial rather than harmful. So again, as usual, in Soto Zen, and Soto Zen practitioners are called bodhisattvas. And for bodhisattvas, nothing is always so. And so this precept, not to become angry, means not to become angry inappropriately. Because not everything is always so. When anger is appropriate, we do become angry. And if we don't become angry when anger is appropriate, we're breaking this precept. So how do we discern the difference between appropriate and inappropriate anger? And Reb Anderson Roshi says that the way we do that is by accepting and studying the teaching of all Buddhas, which we've done. We have studied the three pure precepts, which are the teachings of all Buddhas, which is realized not only when Buddhists, but when the religions of the world, Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, go beyond themselves. The teaching of all Buddhas means the teaching of the entire universe. What is the teaching of the entire universe? It is to refrain from all evil, practice all good, and benefit all beings. Those are the three pure precepts. So can we realize and accept that the whole universe is requesting us and teaching us how to live for the benefit of all beings? Without such a commitment, we can easily be confused and unable to wisely discriminate between appropriate and inappropriate anger and actions, actually all actions. So that's kind of a benchmark for everything in a way. Refrain from evil, practice good, and benefit beings. Just keep that in mind at all times at the grocery store. Thoroughly studying ourselves in terms of these bodhisattva precepts, that's when the precepts show us their light. And seeing this light, we respond appropriately. The precepts show us their light when we study them, when we study ourselves in terms of them. And the light of the precepts shows us the way. But anger and fear obscure the light. However, if we are gentle and loving toward ourselves and stay present with our anger, become intimate with it, the light reemerges. And we most easily do this in Zazen. So we lose the light when we become angry or afraid. It obscures the light of the precepts. The light means their lesson, what they have to say to us, how we should live, how we should behave. And if we see ourselves, most importantly, if we see ourselves within studying these precepts, they will show us, they'll tell us what to do. And it won't even be hard. It will sort of do it automatically. For example, if we witness or experience injustice in the world and we're intimate with it, which means we see ourselves in its reflection, we look at ourselves, we see the light of the precepts. Ultimately, there is no you and me. There's just this one big interconnected thusness. And so if we see ourselves, that means we see all beings, really. And it's the energy and activity of all beings, and it's appropriate and beneficial. Keeping an eye on the light of the precepts will find the way of liberating action for all concerned, the unjust and the oppressed alike. In something called the definitive Vinaya, Vinaya means precepts. So in the definitive Vinaya, Sutra 24 of this particular sutra called Maharatnakuta Sutra, there's the following conversation between the Buddha and his disciple Upali. So Upali asks the Buddha, "World honored one, suppose a bodhisattva breaks a precept out of desire. Another does so out of hatred, and still another does so out of ignorance. World honored one, which one of the three offenses is the most serious?" And hatred can also mean anger, by the way. The world honored one answers Upali, "If a bodhisattva continues to break precepts out of desire for kalpas as numerous as the sands of the Ganges," this is how they talk, "his offense is still minor. If a bodhisattva breaks precepts out of hatred, even just once, his offense is very serious. Why? Because a bodhisattva who breaks precepts out of desire still holds sentient beings in his embrace. Whereas a bodhisattva who breaks precepts out of hatred forsakes sentient beings altogether." Upali, this is the world honored one talking, Buddha talking, Upali, "A bodhisattva should not be afraid of the passions which can help him hold sentient beings in his embrace, but he should fear the passions which can cause him to forsake sentient beings. Upali, as the Buddha has said, desire is hard to give up, but is a subtle fault. Hatred is easy to give up, but is a serious fault. Ignorance is difficult to give up and is a very serious fault." And ignorance, in this context, ignorance means greed, hate, and delusion. I'm going to just use those words. There are other words that are used to mean the same thing. So this goes on. Upali, "When involved in defilements, bodhisattvas should tolerate the small transgressions which are hard to avoid, but should not tolerate the grave transgressions which are easy to avoid, not even in a dream." The bar is high here. The bar is very high. "Don't even dream of transgressions in the realm of," he's calling it, "hatred. For this reason, if a follower of Mahayana breaks precepts out of desire, I, Buddha, say he is not a transgressor. But if he breaks precepts out of hatred, it is a grave offense, a gross fault, a serious degenerate act, which causes tremendous hindrances to the Buddha Dharma." Upali, "If a bodhisattva is not thoroughly conversant with the Vinaya, that is the precepts, he will be afraid when he transgresses out of desire. but will not be afraid when he transgresses out of hatred. You know, monks get violent with each other. They argue all the time. So if a bodhisattva is thoroughly conversant with the Vinaya, the precepts, he will not be afraid when he transgresses out of desire, but he will be afraid when he transgresses out of hatred. So once you learn what the precepts are about, you'll be afraid for yourself when you transgress out of hatred, but you won't be all that worried if you transgress out of desire. But I think that's pretty interesting. So, and hearing this coming straight from the Buddha actually makes me feel it's very clarifying. And these are words right out of the Buddha's mouth. So another Zen master, Yunmen, and Yunmen is one of the patriarchs. He says, all Buddhas are constantly turning the wheel of Dharma in the midst of fierce flames. It means there is pain around all of our meditation seats. It forms a ring of fire. Around this is another ring of fire composed of anger, hate, rage, aggression, disgust, nausea, rejection, aversion, ill will, and violence. This outer ring is an expression of impatiently turning away or trying to control the flames of suffering. At the center of this precept, we acknowledge and honor the tremendous power of these reactions to pain. This is Zen Master Yunmen. And really, patience is the antidote. Through patience, our vision clears. And we can see the dependent co-arising of pain and frustration and anger. Patiently, we can watch this dependent co-arising, this interconnectedness, pain, frustration, anger. Practicing patience does not mean gritting our teeth and ignoring the pain, but developing and expanding our capacity for experiencing pain and opening wide enough to feel the pain without running away or wallowing in it. When we practice patience, the path to harmful anger is blocked. We can face the pain and relax and breathe with it. Anderson Roshi says, the practice of a bodhisattva is to sit upright in the center of the world of universal suffering. Such compassionate beings listen to the pain of the world. They feel it. They ache with it. This is Reb. He says, we are built to ache with it. We are built. That's how we're built, to ache with it. We've evolved to feel the hurt. The upright sitting of the Buddha ancestors never forgets or abandons sentient beings. They sit in the middle of all of the various forms of suffering in order to save all beings. Save all beings always means save all beings from suffering. In practicing this way, we have the same hurt as Shakyamuni Buddha, Bodhidharma, Dogen, and all the great disciples. Sitting courageously at the center, we don't fight back or crumble in the face of pain. We do not get ahead of or lag behind the pain. We do not lean to the right or the left of the pain. We honor and acknowledge all pain. We listen to all pain. The bodhisattva stays close to the pain without meddling or interfering. This is the path of Zen meditation, sitting upright and clearly observing all suffering beings, assembles an ocean of blessings beyond measure. So people wonder, so what am I doing? I'm just sitting here. How is that helping anything? And Reb is saying, sitting upright and clearly observing all suffering beings assembles an ocean of blessings beyond measure. I'm free associating right now to a couple that I counseled yesterday whose problem was that they absolutely were not listening to the each person's pain. If the other person was feeling pain and their voice rose, the other person shut down and they couldn't hear anything. And that was what was happening to both of them. And so I'm talking about, we listen to all pain and stay close to the pain without meddling or interfering, but at least we listen. We listen and we feel it and we ache with it and we don't ignore it. And we sit with it. And I've heard the word radical attached to this path. To be a bodhisattva is radical, and her path is radical. Because we're not seeking merely to quiet our minds or to get calm, but to practice. Bodhisattvas are about practice, not getting calm. So when we sit upright in Zazen, in the middle of all of the suffering of the world, we're not trying to calm ourselves. We're practicing. This means using what comes up in outward circumstances and in our heads, both. Whatever happens can serve as a reminder. Thich Nhat Hanh puts this really beautifully, I think. This is what Thich Nhat Hanh says. Treat your anger with the utmost respect and tenderness, for it is no other than yourself. Do not suppress it. Simply be aware of it. Awareness is like the sun. When it shines on things, they are transformed. When you are aware that you are angry, your anger is transformed. If you destroy anger, you destroy the Buddha. For Buddha and Mara are of the same essence. This is the best sentence. Mindfully dealing with anger is like taking the hand of the little brother. Mindfully dealing with anger is like taking the hand of a little brother. That's Thich Nhat Hanh. And old Chao Chu puts it in a nutshell. Chao Chu is the ninth century Zen master who, maybe you've all heard, it's so famous, the koan, does a dog have Buddha nature? That's the koan. And the Zen master answers, he actually says, woo, and it's, we hear moo. And that means absolute reality. So it's neither existence or non-existence. That's the answer to the koan. Does a dog have Buddha nature? And this old Chao Chu was the Zen master who said that famous koan. So he says about anger. So this is Chao Chu. Buddhahood is passion, and passion is Buddhahood. the monk says, in whom does Buddha cause passion? And Chao Chu says, Buddha causes passion in all of us. And the monk says, how do we get rid of it? And Chao Chu says, why should we get rid of it? By way of ending this section of precept study, I'd like to tell you how John Dido Lurie has developed his own program for Zen training called the Eight Gates of Zen, and has made the study of these precepts one of them. So in John Dido Lurie's monastery, there are eight kind of centers of study, and one of the eight is precept study. So it's like a huge part of their practice. And because he feels that when the Dharma began to take root in this country, there arose a huge misconception about the role of morality and ethics in its practice. For example, he noticed that among tons of books that were coming out about Zen, only one of them kind of addressed a teeny bit. So for some reason, the subject of morals and ethics just got dropped in the discussion of Zen. And so therefore, he has made the study of the Buddhist precepts not only one of his eight gates, but it forms one of his monastery's most vital area of practice. The precepts, he says, are a definition of the life of a Buddha, of how a Buddha functions in the world. They are how enlightened beings live their lives, relate to other human beings, make moral and ethical decisions, and manifest wisdom and compassion in everyday life. As we already know, the precepts are unique among religious ethical teachings in that they are based on the experience of no self. And so at Zen Mountain Monastery, that's Lurie Roshi's seat, even as a lay practitioner, the intention to practice the precepts is taken as a very serious commitment. For example, when a student wants to make the commitment to live her life in accordance with the precepts, she may petition to become a Buddhist. And if she meets the requirements, she enters into a week-long special training to study what that commitment really entails. This is at John Dido Lurie's monastery called Zen Mountain Monastery. It's on the East Coast. The burden is on the prospective student to show what her aspirations and motivations for practice are. In effect, each applicant needs to clarify for herself whether she is a student. So therefore, you have to be a student before you can formally be accepted as one. Basically, that's what this really means. And the same is true for receiving the precepts in the ceremony of Jukai. It is not automatic. Before receiving the precepts, it is important to have entered what Lurie Roshi calls the second stage of training. By that time, the vows that are made during the ceremony serve to confirm something that has already happened. The precepts have become part of one's life. The commitment and the practice are already functioning, and the ceremony merely formalizes that truth. In the beginning, Lurie Roshi says, the precepts are given and received on the basis of faith. At this stage, the student has no personal experience to prove that the precepts are in fact the definition of the life of a Buddha, that is, of how no self might function in the world of samsara. All the student has is the teacher's word and the teachings themselves to go by. That's all a beginning student has, you know, what the teacher says and the teachings themselves. But ultimately, the whole process is something that can only be done by each person individually. You have to really enter, you have to enter each one of these precepts all by yourself. And what anybody says, myself included, is just helpful. It's just helpful, a little bit helpful for what your work is actually. Kind of, that's why I give you homework, to help you. The ripening is called prajna, our wisdom, which is realizing that there is no self, that the self is empty of any fixed definition. Then wisdom begins to function freely, and faith is no longer necessary. Your own experience verifies the precepts. Here are eight important points from today's talk. First, this bodhisattva precept means not to be angry when angry is inappropriate, when anger is inappropriate, but to be angry when anger is appropriate. Both those things, they're both the precept. Even though it says not to become angry, that's what that means. Secondly, the teaching of all Buddhas is the teaching of the entire universe. It is to refrain from evil, practice good, and benefit all beings. This is not just a Buddhist precept or a teaching. It's the teaching of the entire universe. And third, the light of the precepts shows us the way, but anger and fear obscure the light. However, being gentle and loving and fearless with our anger, we become intimate with it, and the light reemerges. Fourth, sitting upright and clearly observing all suffering beings assembles an ocean of blessings beyond measure. Sitting upright and clearly observing all suffering beings assembles an ocean of blessings beyond measure. And fifth, this is the Buddha talking to Upali. Upali, as the Buddha has said, desire is hard to give up, but is a subtle fault. Hatred is easy to give up, but is a serious fault. Ignorance is difficult to give up and is a very serious fault. Sixth, patience is an antidote to anger and the primary condition for enlightenment, actually. Through patience, your vision clears and you see the dependent co-arising of pain, frustration, and anger. They happen together. So when you see anger or feel anger, you can go backwards and just assuming that you're very frustrated and that beneath that is pain. Seventh, this is Thich Nhat Hanh. When you are aware that you are angry, your anger is transformed. If you destroy anger, you destroy the Buddha. For Buddha and Mara are of the same essence. Mindfully dealing with anger is like taking the hand of a little brother. And finally, eighth, in effect, for John Dido Lurie, each applicant needs to clarify for herself whether she is a student. You have to be a student before you can be formally accepted as one. And a student means a student of the precepts, so that your life is organized and your behavior is organized around these 16 precepts. That's why I did this whole series on them. They're incredibly important. They're at the core of Buddhism and Buddhist practice. They're everything because they're our behavior. So for your notebooks this week, please, for your own sakes, reflect deeply on the following. I'm giving you five things. And first, are you a student? And do you even want to be? And to be a student means to take the Buddha's teachings to heart as if they are words from your very own heart. Take the Buddha's feet. That's what makes you a student. You take the Buddha's teachings to heart, and these precepts are all the Buddha's teachings, as if they were coming from your own heart. So they're just you being you. That's being a student. And if you aren't interested and you don't want to, and you like, ugh, no, then, you know, that is absolutely your choice. And this practice is not for you, and that's all there is to it. And there are many other practices out there. So so to reflect on this and know where you stand. That's the first thing to think about this week. And secondly is how is it so? Just ask yourself the question, how is it so that the three pure precepts, refrain from all evil, practice all good, and benefit all beings, is the key to lack of confusion? How is that? It has been said that without such a commitment, we will be confused and unable to wisely discriminate between appropriate and inappropriate actions. And so do you understand how this works? And for your assignment this week, the next time you get angry, watch your mind really carefully, and then bring in, just try it, the three pure precepts, bring them in right in the moment, you know. Oh, wait, refrain from all evil, practice all good, benefit all beings. Just wait a minute, think about that and see what happens. That's number two. And the third is, what do you think about Buddha's words to Upali? Desire is hard to give up, but it is a subtle fault. Hatred is easy to give up, but is a serious fault. And ignorance is difficult to give up, but is a very serious fault. What do you think of that? And please speak from your own experience. I'm curious what you think of that. Fourth is Thich Nhat Hanh's statement, mindfully dealing with anger is like taking the hand of a little brother. What does that mean to you? What does that actually mean to you? And fifth, and this is a really important one, since patience is so important, because through patience, your vision clears and you see the dependent co-arising. Everything co-arises, pain, frustration, and anger. If you don't already have a formal way of practicing patience, then please use this opportunity to devise one. For example, I use traffic as an opportunity to practice patience. Traffic provides a terrific mirror, not always flattering, I'm sorry to say, but sometimes, I'm getting better. Standing in lines also works, dealing with bureaucracy, and even sometimes dealing with sales clerks, sometimes, are other things that have occurred to me, at least, as ways of formally practicing patience. So you decide beforehand. I just, whenever I get in my car, you know, I'm actually practicing patience. That's what I'm actually doing. And so I'm suggesting that you find a way to really, really find a way to make patience, the practice of patience, a conscious aspect of your life, because it's incredibly important in dealing with these precepts. And the precepts ideally will become your benchmark for all of your behavior. And they make deciding how to behave very, very super clear. So as I've promised you, this would be the time for questions, and I urge you to ask questions. But today I'm going to kind of butt in and answer my own question to you. The one I left you at the beginning of the talk, you're a mother coming home from work, etc. So the question is, what will you think? There's your new au pair on the couch, and your kids are fighting on the floor, and everything's a mess. And what do you think, and what do you do with this situation of your brand new au pair, obviously doing nothing but talking on his cell phone? So the answer is, mentally, of course you think, thank you very much. I have no complaints whatsoever. And why? Because everything that comes to you is a gift. And in this case, the gift is the insight that the anger that would have been appropriate for you to feel toward your own non-virtue, perhaps because you were careless in your selection of childcare for your toddlers, is reflected back to you in the form of this boy's negligence. Do you see how it works? He's like totally negligent, and you hired him, and your anger toward yourself at your own non-virtue in like missing that, you know, beat, you miss that beat of who would be the best possible option to hire for an au pair, and what is the process of finding that person, is now reflected back to you. You were not careful enough. So regarding doing, so now that's thinking, thank you very much, I have no complaints whatsoever, because everything that comes to you is a gift, including this. And then, so that's your thinking. And then regarding doing, soon now, soon, but not now. This is not the time, but soon you'll set clearer boundaries, clearer expectations, and even perhaps clearer consequences with your au pair. That's the answer to the question. And these questions are there to help you. If you didn't get this question right, if you didn't answer the way I just said, what was the answer? Then it's a sign that you're not integrating these talks as fully as you might. I mean, they're here for you. And I would just urge you to do the homework, really do the reason I give those questions for you, I'm saying for your notebooks, because writing really, really, really helps integration. And integration is the key. You know, hearing something is in one ear and out the other, but having to reflect on them. And I design these questions for action. I mean, I design them as action plans, how to take what I'm teaching and then embody them, and they show up in your behavior, even if it's just, what do I think about that? That's a real action. And then if you write about it, then you kind of, oh, well, that's what I think about it. You know, I don't agree. And here's why. Okay, so that's what I'm giving you in this first question of an insight into how well are you integrating these talks. So I'm done now. I'm ready for someone else to ask a question.
Thank you, Gail. So we have about 12 minutes. So I'll go a little quick because we have some questions here. So the first one is, thank you, Gail. This is not a question. I just wanted to express my enormous gratitude to you for these teachings and for the team behind the scenes who made this possible for all of us. I have found this series enormously beneficial and clarifying. The precepts are so powerful, and I really appreciate your help in presenting them to us and giving us ways to contemplate on them and bring them into my daily life. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm very moved. Thank you so much for that. Thank you so much.
So the next one is, you mentioned to be a bodhisattva is radical. Why do you like the word radical to describe the practice?
I like it because usually we think of radicals, like political radicals, as kind of violent. Maybe I'm the only one that connects violence, marches and getting together and destroying people's property and all of that is associated with radical political beliefs. And I just love the idea that sitting upright in silence for a fairly long time is also a radical practice. I just, I enjoy that word used in this radical opposite sense. That's all. That's why I like it. Thank you.
So the next one is, the Buddha has said desire is hard to give up, but is a subtle fault. Hatred is easy to give up, but is a serious fault. Ignorance is difficult to give up, and is a very serious fault. Actually, I find hatred really hard to give up and desire rather easy. I guess I hold a grudge, so my anger stews. Time does nothing. It takes forever for some broader view to soften it away.
What a great question. That's a really great question, because I think a lot of us might feel that, myself included. It seems to me that it's the opposite. But either way, patience is still the key, because patience gives the broad view. If you're patient, you can have a broad view. But in the moment, as you're trying to deal with the toxic nature of your fury, you know, we're we angry ones are the ones who suffer the most. The person, sometimes no one even knows that we, you know, we're the ones who have to deal with all the toxicity from our furiousness. But if you can figure out how to learn something, like what's the gift in the middle of it, sort of like the example of the mother, if she could find the reflection of herself, of her own, I won't use the word carelessness, but it wasn't her investigation to find the right au pair was definitely not deep enough. And then she saw it completely, you know, this boy on the couch was like, you, I'm you, honey. So if you can find that nugget, then you get a gift from the whole thing. So in a way, that nugget is the broader view. I guess that's my answer. Again, you know, practicing patience, it's really hard. And it's very important. We'll deal with patience, by the way, in the next series that I'll talk about in a minute at the end. It's one of the six, what we call paramitas, or perfections. And it's the ways Bodhisattva kind of think of their, how to situate themselves in the world. And patience is one of them. So we're not done with that topic. Okay.
So the next one we have is, my question is on the idea of not to be angry when anger is inappropriate, and to be angry when anger is appropriate. I have a lot of anger. How can I trust myself to tell if one circumstance is appropriate and in another it isn't? I guess I am saying I don't trust myself.
The benchmark is the three pure precepts, which we did study. Refrain from all evil, practice all good, and benefit all beings. And I guess you think, well, you may not have thought to use that. But you can also ask, and this may be easier to ask, is this my anger or is this anger for humanity? So each case, is this my anger or is this anger for humanity? Because being angry at Charlie is a lot different from being angry at the Holocaust. So like bread, putting your anger in the oven of Zazen really helps. It really, really helps. I think it helps. One thing that doesn't help is venting. And Zazen, I think because it just sits there with it and acknowledges it and shines, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, shines the light on it, the light of the sun on it, it's transformed. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So so the next one is, I love Thich Nhat Hanh's words, mindfully dealing with anger is like taking the hand of a little brother. It makes me see really clearly how much of my anger is like a child's tantrum. And then picturing myself as the oldest child having to quiet my little brother, I watch myself distract him, change his situation for the better so that we can then talk through what just happened. I might have to distract him again. All of this shows my own mind only too clearly.
I know, it reminds me of last week. I think it was last week when we talked about controlling our trying. We talked about control and not even, this is a pretty sophisticated practice, but not even controlling ourselves. And you may not be there yet. I'm not sure I am. But remember, again, Thich Nhat Hanh's words, awareness is like the sun. And when it shines on things, they're transformed. Once you notice what you're doing, you see your mind. You see your mind, and that you're three quarters of the way there. Most people in that situation just have their own tantrum, and then there's just chaos all over the place. One person screams, and then the other person screams, and this idea of, in a way, seeing your anger as like having a hissy fit, you know, like you're having, like a child having a tantrum, you know, over, you know, she took my toy. it's seeing yourself really clearly. And it helps a lot. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So this is the last question that we will take. Does self-criticism mean I'm not practicing, that I am just thinking of myself as an individual? If I can see all as one, will perfectionism dissolve? Brackets, but seeking positive change continue.
I'm not sure I understand the question. I'm sorry, because of time, I'm just gonna answer something that might help. I don't know that we want perfectionism to dissolve. It's what you're trying to be perfect at. So what we're going to study next in the next, it's just a 7-week series, is really perfectionism. It's really, well, it isn't, no, I shouldn't say, it's not perfectionism, but it's perfections. We're going to study the perfection of generosity and the perfection of patience. Perfectionism does need to dissolve because it's too opinionated and it's too about you. And when it's all about you, then it's not about all sentient beings. I mean, you could contradict that and say, well, you are all sentient beings, but just for the sake of time, we're talking about your ego. There's a difference between when something is about you and your ego and if something is about humanity in general. And I think that's the distinction I was trying to make. I'm not sure I answered, but I don't think that we have more time. Ask again. We're not meeting next week, but the next time we meet, ask again if I didn't answer. Before we, and the reason I'm in a hurry here is that I want to be sure to tell you, just a moment. I don't want to tell you the wrong thing. Again, I'd like to give you a calendar for the next several months. Next week, we'll take a break, so we won't meet next Sunday, but beginning the following Sunday, October 10th, and for 7 weeks, ending November 21st, which is the Sunday before Thanksgiving, we will have the last series in what I'm calling level one. So we're going to finish what I'm calling level one on November 21st. And the last series in that will be called The Six Practices of Wisdom and Compassion on the Bodhisattva Path. There are six of them, including generosity and patience are two. And they're known as the paramitas or the perfections. And in January, on Sunday the 9th, I'll begin the first module of level two. And I'm very excited to have permission from you to teach on this subtler level. But I can see from your attention and your questions that you're ready. So watch out for email blasts and be sure to register so that you'll be sent the appropriate links. There'll be several email blasts and look out for them so that you'll have the links that you need for this series, this last series, and also the series in January. Thank you.